This is the state of things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. North Carolina's Department of Public Instruction has a few things on its agenda this year. The first, attrition rates. Numbers released Wednesday show the state's high school dropout rate edged up to about 3.3% last year, or nearly 21,000 students. State education officials aren't only looking at how to keep kids in school, but how to make sure they graduate with a diploma that means something in the wider world, to employers and to colleges. Last fall, the Department of Public Instruction put forth a proposal for more stringent graduation requirements. Under the plan, students would have to pass end-of-course exams and complete a senior project in order to graduate. DPI has just wrapped up a series of public forums across the state, but not everyone got a chance to voice their opinion. What do you make of the proposal for tougher high school graduation requirements? Is it time to tighten up graduation requirements? We welcome your calls this hour, 1-877-962-9862. Joining us on the line from Greensboro is Bruce Buchanan, education reporter for the Greensboro News and Record. Thanks for joining us today, Bruce.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Rusty. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and now we'll get to the attrition rates in a second or in a minute, but let's start with high school graduation requirements. Last fall, the State Department of Public Instruction put together a proposal that would make earning a high school diploma more difficult than it has been. So let's first lay out what's in the proposal, these end-of-course exams. Tell us what's in the proposal.
Okay, well, these are not new tests. Students have been taking these for nearly a decade. They're standardized, multiple-choice exams, and students take them in a number of subjects, but the five subjects under consideration are sort of core academic courses: Algebra 1, Biology, English 1, Civics and Economics, and U.S. History. There's two proposals on the table. One would require students to pass all five of those exams, and the other would give them a little more leeway. They would just need to pass any four of those five. Under consideration as a part of this is requiring students to complete a senior project during their senior year of high school.
So the tests in and of themselves are not new, but the requirements and the numbers of tests they'd have to pass is new. What are the current requirements for earning the high school diploma?
Currently, the requirements are, well, the primary requirement is students have to earn at least 20 course credits. And that's not going to change. Students still will have to earn a sufficient number of credits to graduate. That's the main requirement. Also, students currently have to pass what's called the competency test. I know I took it when I was coming up through high school in Shelby. And students have to pass that. But I think there is that test is really written more at the middle school level. I think everyone acknowledges that it's not a true comprehensive reflection of what high school students need in order to earn a diploma. So these, if approved, these new exit standards would replace the competency test, which, like I said, is the consensus is it's pretty much obsolete.
So before we get to this big question of why the proposal to raise the standards, officials think this is going to address, first, so we're talking really about changing the value of these tests. Right now, they currently only account for a portion of the student's grade, right?
Well, a pretty significant portion, 25%. That's a lot riding on one test. And these are the same tests that are currently used to evaluate schools under the ABCs of public education program, you know, where you know each school gets basically an evaluation based on these test scores. Teacher pay bonuses depend on that evaluation. So these are already high stakes tests, but now not only are the schools and the teachers going to have a lot riding on these, but the students will as well.
Is there, just since you mentioned the teachers and the fact that bonuses are somehow tied to end of year test results, any opposition or resistance from them?
For this proposal?
Right.
Well, I think that so far there's been a mixed reaction. I think teachers pretty much have come to accept the fact that high-stakes testing is a part of the educational landscape. There's really no getting around that. It's a national trend as well as a state trend. I think there has been some concern in some circles that schools, you know, are putting too much emphasis on these tests and not enough on all the other things that that go into to making a well-rounded high school student.
You're talking about teaching to the test, right?
Yeah, I mean that's what you hear critics say. Now proponents would say that teaching to the test is all that is making sure students need to have what they need in order to have a meaningful high school diploma. That that it's kind of honing in on those core academic subjects like English and U.S. history and algebra. You know, the things that students really do need to know. So that's kind of the flip side of it.
Right. We're talking with Greensboro News and Record education reporter Bruce Buchanan about changes being considered by the Department of Public Instruction to end-of-course exams. So, Bruce, why? Why do officials, education officials, think these standards need to be raised, need to be changed? What are high school students not getting?
Well, I think if you talk to most educators, they'll tell you that North Carolina's elementary and middle schools are much stronger than they were 10 or 20 years ago. Then a number of reform measures aimed at beefing up the middle and elementary school grades. But that wave of reform has kind of passed the high schools by, at least for the most part. They really haven't changed that much in 100 years, at least not compared to the lower grades. And I think you're hearing that in the North Carolina's changing economy that students today simply aren't prepared for the job market. You're hearing that from a lot of business leaders. They're saying that high school just simply needs to be more rigorous and students are graduating from high school without the basic skills needed to enter the workplace or go to a community college. I'm not sure about I saw this exact number and it escapes me, but it's a pretty staggering percentage of community college students in the state who need some type of remedial work. I want to say it's about 40%. So there's a big group of students who are graduating from high school and who just simply aren't ready for the life beyond.
Is that the only measuring stick, though? I'm wondering, you know, what the concern is based on. Besides the number of people needing remedial courses, are there any comparisons being made to other states?
Well, not really any comparisons made to other states. I think pretty much every state's in the same boat. It's really more just anecdotal accounts, but very widespread from employers. Obviously the state's economy has changed tremendously in the past 10, 20 years. In the previous generations, you could come out of high school. You could even drop out of high school and get a good paying job in textiles or furniture or tobacco. And those types of jobs really are going away if they even exist at all in many towns. And the jobs that are available just simply require a greater level of education.
1-877-962-9862, the number to call if you want to get in on the conversation about end-of-course exams. We're talking with Bruce Buchanan, Greensboro News and Record education reporter. Bruce, this would go into effect when? These changes would affect which students right now?
Well, they would affect students currently in the seventh grade, so no students who are in high school now would be affected by these. It's the class of 2010. However, they would start taking these tests as ninth graders, so it's really not as far off as it may seem. Mm-hmm. The students would be in eighth grade next year in the 2005-06 school year, so they would kind of have 1 year to get ready or a little over a year to get ready.
I'm just curious, what impact would these changes have on the state's graduation rate? Would we see a precipitous decline in the number of students receiving diplomas because the standards got raised?
It's possible, but my gut feeling is no. I think there would be perhaps some decline, but it won't be as great as you think. And here's why. Students will have multiple chances to retake any test they fail, at least two more chances. So just because a student fails the first time around, they're going to get extra help. They're going to have one-on-one tutoring, intense extra help, and then a chance to take the test at least two more times. So I think with that extra help, there the number of students who were able to pass these requirements will be the vast majority. Probably 80 to 90%. I would right. estimate.
And we should point out too that principals are likely to have the right to overrule the test results, right?
Yeah, that's
and
kind
hand
of,
out diplomas.
That's actually the one big loophole in all this, and it's kind of the X factor. We don't know how that's going to come into play. According to the proposal on the table, a high school principal can basically just throw out these standards and award a diploma to a student who hasn't passed all of the tests if they think they are worthy. I was just going to say that, we really don't know how that's going to play out until students actually start failing the test.
Right. Bruce, we have just a little time left, and I want to ask you at least one question about attrition rates, but
sure.
Give us a forward-looking timeline with end-of-course exams. What will people hear next about this issue?
Well, the State Board of Education will have to approve this. I believe they are probably going to take this up in March. I don't know if they'll have it finalized by then, but obviously this is something they want to get out of the way as soon as possible so teachers, parents, and students can begin preparing. I don't think this is going to drag out.
Bruce, in about 20 seconds, just tell me how significant are the attrition rates that we've seen this year?
Actually, this year was roughly unchanged from last year. I think if you look at it as a trend, though, fewer North Carolina students are dropping out of high school, although still more than 20,000 dropped out last year, and that's a pretty big number.
I'm going to stop you there. Bruce Buchanan, education reporter for the Greensboro News and Record, thanks so much for joining us. This is The State of Things, and coming up, we're going to be talking with Chilean playwright Ariel Dorfman. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. A psychological thriller by Ariel Dorfman doesn't rely on props or elaborate lighting to create dramatic tension. In his new play, Purgatorio, he puts a woman and a man in an undefined space and lets them taunt each other with provocative questions. It's a chess match where the tables turn constantly, the characters alternating in the roles of victim and oppressor. Purgatorio premieres this weekend as a workshop production presented by Duke University's Theater Previews. Exiled from Chile after the 1973 coup, Dorfman is a scholar, a novelist, a poet, and an award-winning playwright. His work has been translated into 30 different languages in over 100 countries. His 1992 play Death and the Maiden played on Broadway with Glenn Close, Richard Dreyfuss, and Gene Hackman, and was made into a film with Ben Kingsley and Sigourney Weaver. Ariel Dorfman joins me now from the studio at Duke University, where he is a professor of literature and Latin American studies. And thanks for being with us, Ariel Dorfman.
Well, it's a very special pleasure to be with you today, Rusty.
So your new play, Purgatorio, has just two characters known as man and woman, right?
Well, yes. I mean, but when you say there are two characters, that doesn't mean there are two actors there. But we all have many, many personalities inside us, and they are vying to come out. So there's a lot of the play is about finding out who these people are, and they themselves have got to find out who they are and surprise the audience and surprise themselves.
So the actors portraying these characters go through the same journey that the audience does in terms of self-discovery.
Yeah, there are moments when they are ahead of us and then moments when we're ahead of them. But watching this process of working on it, I realize that it's very much a shuttle. It's very much back and forth. One has the power at certain moments and dominates. And then all of a sudden, she or he, if it turns out to be the other way around, turns the tables very, very quickly. And they're sort of going back and forth, back and forth. And by the end of the play, we'll find out who's going to win this contest. Or perhaps both are going to win or both are going to lose. We're going to find that out.
Or rather,
you're going to find it out if you come.
And I think the power shifting is a thematic thread with some of your other work that I want to address in a sec. But just tell us what you can about the play, about Purgatorio's setting.
Well, I had this vision of a man and a woman in a room. And all I knew is that she was trying to escape and he in some way was trying to help her. It came to me in a dream some years ago. And I set out to write this. I was so absolutely taken. It shook me. It shattered me, really. And I said, I just have to sit down and begin to write this. And when I started, I did not know who they were. I really had no idea whatsoever. And then very slowly, it began to dawn on me let's just say that there were some people in history or in legend or in myth that I had been very interested in visiting. People who had done terrible things to one another, who are almost archetypes of the worst thing that a man can do to a woman and the worst thing that a woman can do to a man. And all of a sudden I said, oh, what if they're this woman, what if they're that man? And all of a sudden I realized that it would be very interesting if I put them together in a place like a purgatorial place, a sort of almost like an insane asylum or a hospital or, you know, between four walls, floating in ether, someplace like that. And they're going to have to work it out. They're going to have to decide how they redeem themselves. I mean, I was always interested in the question, what happens if, in order to be saved, saved in many ways, religiously, saved humanly, saved almost from drowning, if the one person who can do that is the person you've most damaged, and then turn it around in the sense that the person who's doing the saving has also been in the same position. So I tried to play a sort of a game in which I show this, and then it turns into a very serious game. The only prop that is there, by the way, is a knife. The knife is there very clearly at the very start. There's a knife there, sticking out of a cube in the scenery. So things are very dangerous.
I mean, atonement, repentance, these very, very religious themes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not a particularly religious person. I have a mystical streak in me. But I think that we all look for some way in which we can undo or at least repair those terrible things that we may have done to others. I don't believe that we can go through life without hurting other people. I think it's a process of learning. It's a process of pain. And some of us have what Martin Luther King used to call creative suffering, and some of us are unable to get there. You know, we just turn suffering either into hurting somebody else more when we get more power, or becoming this sort of cringing victim and playing the card of victimization. Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so bad. Please forgive me, you know. And I think that we need to get out of that terrible paradox and that terrible sort of circuit, that circle of viciousness and sorrow. And one of the ways to do it, I mean, is to explore how a man and a woman would do it in the worst of circumstances. I sort of wanted to find a situation which every man and every woman, every person in the world could identify with the man at some point and with the woman at another point, and try to figure out why they'd done what they'd done and how they can work it out together. Except that the joke on them, or the joke that I played on them, is that they don't seem to know who the other person is. So it's a cat and mouse of trying to figure out the identity of, let's say, the therapist and the patient, or the oppressor and the resident of this asylum or this refuge or this purgatorial place.
I have to. I saw a little bit of a rehearsal the other day, and I was struck in watching the characters work with each other. There were moments. There seemed to be moments of tenderness and then utter cruelty. Is would you say that's accurate?
I think that is absolutely accurate. I mean, you know, the question always is, how do you break open the other so the other can see you? And that may be done with acts of cruelty that very quickly turn into acts of tenderness. You know, I'm a very nonviolent person, and I believe very strongly in nonviolence and in peace. At the same time, that doesn't mean that I don't believe that people should not tell each other the truth very, very, very harshly at times. At times, it's necessary to do that. I think, in fact, literature very often is that knife. In fact, Kafka used to say that literature is the pickaxe that breaks the frozen sea inside us. And I think that's an absolute, I mean, that's a gem for me. That's what you're supposed to do. So words are also that. And I'm always looking for art to do that, to shake us in such a way that when we come out of the theater, in this case, or out of a picture exhibition, or see a photography, or listen to some music, we are just devastated, but devastated in the most wonderful ways, in the sense that we catch a glimpse of who we might be, of all the other people we might be. And that's what literature and plays particularly do. They give us this capacity of compassion and empathy towards the other, but also it's compassion and empathy of identifying with somebody who may be somebody really terrible. It's a territory which is a very interesting one to explore, which I've done in Death and the Maiden, but I've done in this play as well.
And I want to address it. Do you want to increase the power of words to shatter? Is that one of the reasons why you have sparsely, you know the set's spare, it's minimal, and you don't use a lot of props?
Well, it's a play which, first of all, this is a workshop production, mm-hmm. meaning, you know, the actor's going to be with a script in their hand. So we've only had 10 days to rehearse. We mm-hmm. haven't had the 4 or 5 weeks which we'll have when we go to Broadway. On the other hand, people can come for $15 and they won't pay $100, which they'd have to pay in Broadway or on the West End in London when it opens there very, very shortly, I think. So, you know, it's a workshop production. I was very interested in people coming and my listening with the audience to the words. This is very much about words. It's very much about the fact that people use words to hide and use people to they use words to reveal the truth. Mm. So language has that very wonderful ambiguity to it, that it can serve to cover who we are, what we're thinking, deny, escape, you know, a sort of a jungle of words or a purgatory of words. And then also there are words that simply slice through you like a wonderful sword, like the sword of the Lord, let's say, in that sense, right? They just put you there. And it's very much about people speaking to one another. But, you know, a great deal of the plays, the most wonderful plays in the world, and I'm not saying mine is particularly wonderful in that sense. I hope it is, but they're about people speaking to one another. Not very much more goes on. And one of the reasons why I think we want to go to a play rather than see a film is because in a film there's so much action, especially today. You know, there's such a surfeit of it. And here it's a matter of sitting down and figuring out who they are. And it's lethal, though. You know, language can be lethal. I'll tell you, very often I would much rather have somebody slap my face with with a hand, I guess, than to slap my face with a word that can hurt. And I think we all know exactly what that is. Of course, at times it can be both, and that's even worse. But words are very, very particular, and people manipulate one another. They work on their guilt, but they also work on their glory, their hope, their tenderness. There are moments when the woman speaks about herself in such a way that the man is very moved, and vice versa. And so it's this movement between going back and forth, this flow, this sea, this liquid, this fire of words, which goes back and forth, which I think is just very enjoyable. It's also, it's very absurd at times, so it's very funny at times. People laugh, or have at least in rehearsals.
I want to share with you something, because I was reminded of this when you were talking about forcing a man and a woman into a space and having them just work it out, out. Someone told me recently about how a rabbi once counseled a married couple. You know, and I know you're from a Jewish tradition as well, like I am. When couples get married, they break a glass and often save the pieces. And I think a rabbi said, you know, if you ever get to the point where you feel like things are breaking down and you have to, separate, get into a room, open up that box with all the pieces of glass and don't leave until you put it back together.
That's a fantastic story, Rusty. I'll tell you why, because a part that you didn't see in the rehearsal is that the woman brings out a vase. Here, we're not going to see it, but let's say when it's full production, we're going to see this Grecian urn, a very beautiful one, you know. You know these that you see in the Metropolitan Museum, those that are black and orange, those beautiful, beautiful vases, right? Mm-hmm. And it's very much related to one of the crimes that or errors or omissions, mistakes that the man may or may not have committed. And all of a sudden, towards the end of that, when they've gone through that, because of some slight movement, it breaks. It shatters at their feet. And they both go down automatically and begin to bring it together. It's the first time they do something together. And he says, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't. No, it's my fault. And all of a sudden, they're piecing it together, both of them on their knees, you know. Mm. They've been on their knees to each other in different occasions through the play. This comes more or less towards the end of the play. It's not the real end of the play, but they're moving in that direction. And all of a sudden, you have them both on their knees, both at, you know, looking at each other across a room and working on this glass that was shattered. I don't know if some rabbi in my past was telling me how to do this, you know, because the play has a Catholic aspect to it, the purgatory thing, you know, certainly Christian, a very Buddhist one, because there's very much talk about reincarnation. There's a very Sufi attitude towards it, you know, in the sense of the idea that you take the veils off and you see and you go on a journey in that sense, and certainly a Jewish tradition which comes from that. And my own tradition, which is, I guess, an agnostic tradition, in which I have no idea what happens to us after death. I doubt that we're going to be put in the room, but the fact is the room is not really the afterlife. It is put in the head of a man and a woman who are in that rabbi room, let's say, and they say, get into that room with the glass you've shattered, put it together, and you know what? You may have to bloody your fingers to do it, but boy, will you be able to drink together out of that glass if you manage it.
So you mentioned all these religious traditions that show up, and I have to ask if there's a kind of an existentialist tradition, because I'm reminded in this small space, in this setting that you've created of Sartre's We Clo, or No Exit. And
yes,
I'm wondering if
no
that
exit.
Makes sense.
Well, you know something, I was very, very, I'm very influenced by existentialism, by Sartre, by Camus, by the whole, you know, especially by many of the philosophers, Kierkegaard, and I read them extensively when I was a young man from 17, 18. It was the time, you know, of the French existentialist, and I saw all the films. So it's moved me very much, and I read No Exit very early in my life. And I always thought, well, I'd like to do that, you know. But in the case of the Sartre play, I almost thought of calling this Exit, because I think that what I was interested in doing wasn't showing a humanity, which Sartre says everybody is a salaud, everybody's sort of like a bad person, you know, a person with a bad conscience. And I think people have got bad conscience, and I think they have this enormous possibility of redemption. So it's a very Latin American play in that sense, in the search for hope. And the search for my own idea. You know, people always were asking me, they're saying, well, you have the death penalty, right? You're against the death penalty, which I am. You know, my plays, I even have opened a play recently in Atlanta. We did it, Martin Luther King, the holiday down in Atlanta with Sean Penn and Lynn Redgrave and Martin Sheen and mm-hmm. Woody Harrelson. It's a human rights play. It's against the death penalty. Sister Helen Prejean was there, et cetera. So they asked me, there in Atlanta, they asked me, well, you know, you're against the death penalty, but what about Hitler, you know? And, of course, there's always the question of Hitler or somebody like Hitler or Stalin or people like that, you know? And my answer is I'm against the death penalty in any case, which doesn't mean I'm not against fighting in self-defense for the people that you love, you know? I would hope that I wouldn't kill somebody, but I'm speaking about the execution of people by the state. I'm against that, no matter what heinous crime it is. And behind that, There's been for many years the question of, but you know, what would happen if what happens to these souls? If these souls do exist, where do they go? Where does Hitler's soul go? But it's not very interesting to find out what happens to Hitler, you know, because it's so vast. And I'm very interested in finding out what happens when one person has done something terrible to one other person and they find themselves in the room with that person and somebody says to them, some God or some law of the universe, if you don't fix this, you're not getting out of here. You've got to fix it somehow. Well, how do you fix it? How do you fix that without saying, just obliterate them, just get rid of them, right? Somebody's done something terrible to you. I mean, even politically, somebody's done terrible to you. Do you go and you squash them like an insect? You defend yourself, certainly. You have to defend yourself. Those are police actions you need to take. But do you go beyond that and find ways of redeeming that? Is there a way of redeeming people who you say, oh, that person is beyond salvation, right? Well, is everybody beyond salvation? I don't know. But I'm interested in people taking that journey with me, you know, and going beyond the immediate sense of, oh, you know, let's get rid of this person, because then it's very easy. It's very easy to get rid of the person who committed the crime and make believe you've got rid of the crime and make believe of the fact that you know, what you're really trying to get rid of is the person who's saying to you, you might be like me, given the circumstances. I am your brother, right? Remember the Bible once again, right? When Cain says he's going to go out, he says, but look, Lord, he says, they're going to stone me. They're going to kill me. They're going to mock me. They won't. And he puts a mark upon him. The Lord puts a mark upon him. Here I am, you know, spouting wisdom of the Bible. But it really is very important to say, well, why did he mark him? He marked him so people would not kill him. In other words, so the first brother killing a brother in history, the first one that we know of in our Judeo-Christian Western tradition, mm-hmm. and this happens in other places, by the way, as well. It happens in the Hindus and it happens in the Buddhists. It happens all over. They say, we will not kill that person. That person will be marked in some way. Well, it's as if I had put a mark upon my two characters and say, you cannot kill each other. You must work it out in some way.
Find some other way, yeah.
it may not be possible for you to work it out. I mean, there's always that open. The woman says to him, you know, what if you just can't? What if you just have to really just get rid of the souls? You just get rid of them, you know, and give me forgiveness and forgetfulness forever. Maybe I'm not worth it, right? These are difficult questions we ask, but, you know, these are the questions that literature, that theater has got to ask. And I would be really remiss if I didn't ask the right questions. I'm asking them myself. I'm in anguish myself and glory myself for writing these things.
Yeah, I do. I want to get into the question later of whether you think you have some of the answers to these questions. But I do want to point something out that
You've got the answer. I mean, seriously, the audience has the answer. They will have to decide. But I do indicate a direction in which things are going, you know. When both of them are equal and look at each other, when they're able to look at each other for the first time, maybe they can start working things out. I'm moving in that direction, but it's not sure that that's what happens. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No. It's fine. I just people will maybe assume, even from Death and the Maiden, your 1992 play, that this might be, something about state on individual violence. But you really are talking here about the person, you know, family on family, friend on friend. You're talking about a whole spectrum of brutality from person to person, state to person. Is
that
right?
Well, it's true. Yeah, I mean, first of all, Death and the Maiden is about a state that has employed people to torture others and which ends up destroyed by this. So that is, I don't know, if that music is for us?
Yeah, you have 15 seconds and then I got to take it from you.
Okay, and that's the end.
No. We're coming back.
Oh, okay. Then I'll just say, you know, that we'll come back then, and I'll develop
all right.
This.
That sounds great. Well, we're having a great conversation here with Duke University Literature and Latin American Studies professor Ariel Dorfman, whose play Purgatorio premieres as a workshop production at Duke this weekend. Just ahead, more with Ariel Dorfman. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. We're talking with Ariel Dorfman, professor of literature and Latin American studies at Duke University. He's also a novelist, poet, and playwright. His new play, Purgatorio, premieres as a workshop production at Duke this weekend. And Ariel Dorfman is with us from the studios at Duke University. So, Ariel, I wanted to ask you first about the themes that Purgatorio shares with your play, Death and the Maiden.
Right. Well, I mean, what I was saying is that we are in a situation where the state in Death and the Maiden had ordered the torture of a female prisoner, of many, many people, and it was inspired by the situation in Chile. So that was a political situation and had to do with something terrible that was happening at the state level. But it happened to individual people. The reason why that play works and why the film, the Polanski film, works, at least I think so, is because it happens to very concrete people who have their own problems. I mean, the problem of the silence, the problem of betrayal, it all has to do with three characters who are very real and who have to interact. In other words, they can't solve the problem at the state level only. They have to solve it as Paulina's got to ask, well, who am I? Am I like this man who has tortured me and raped me, or am I different? Will I do the same things to him? Those are the questions that need to be asked. Now, in Purgatorio, it's very, very different in the sense that I came out of Death and the Maiden with two fundamental questions. The first we've talked about, which is, well, how do you redeem somebody if they have tortured somebody else, if they have hurt somebody else, if they've raped somebody else? How do you redeem that person? Is that person irredeemable? But the second question has to do with, in order for a system to work, such as the system of torture, you need people to be complicitous. In other words, it is done one by one by one. Crimes are not done by a system. The system helps people to make those crimes, you know. I mean, in that sense, we always have to look at how we can change systems, how we can change states, how we can change policies, right? The U.S. policy in Iraq, for instance, in relation to torture, we have to change that. The policy that comes out of bin Laden's calling for beheading of people, we have to change that. Because we have to change those ways of understanding the world, because they are deeply corrupting of the individuals who follow those orders, right? Mm-hmm. The question then, however, is that at the individual level, the person doesn't ask about the policy. He or she asks, well, what do I do? Why did I do this? And so very often, these forms of damage of the other happen in the bedroom first. They happen with the child very often. They happen with the older person. They happen with the beggar. They happen with the poor. They happen with the way in which the poor react against the rich. So We are stuck in relationships which breed violence, damage, lack of forgiveness, really vengeance constantly. So I was very interested in taking this situation away from the overtly political in order for this man and this woman in my play Purgatorio to work it out as two human beings. That doesn't mean that they should not, that we should not, you know, work for a world where these things won't happen. But it turns out that I think that some of these things will happen no matter what. You know, men will do certain things to women and women will do certain things to men, no matter what social system we've got. And therefore, we have got to work out certain things in relationship to how we confront one another, how we live with one another. This has to do with the day-by-day redemption, the day-by-day understanding, forgiveness, going back and forth, which makes our lives livable. And so I wanted to take these very specific people and confront them with one another. And then if we want to draw political conclusions out of that, people can do that. I have no problem with that. I love them to do that. But I don't want this only to be a problem where, you know, people would say, Death and the Maiden, well, you know, let's get rid of torture. But, you know, even if you get rid of torture, you're not going to get rid of the fact that certain people want to torture others, or certain people have enormous power over others, or certain men betray certain women, or certain women are terribly scared when certain things happen to them. How do we deal with those issues? And those are the ones that I think bring people into the theater, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't think people come into the theater to be convinced that violence is evil or something of the sort. You know, it would be ridiculous or absurd or useless, in fact, for me to say that. It's for people to live through the experience. In that it's very, very much about identity, you know, very much about who are we? These people will find out, but the audience also needs to find out, who am I? Who do I identify with here? Am I going to go through this process myself? Don't I go through this process with the people that I love day after day? I would hope in a lesser scale that people haven't quite caused the damage that these two have to one another.
I hear in a lot of what you're saying, first of all, the theme of personal responsibility and going back to some of what you were saying about torture and state endorsed torture. I hear that age old question of, you know, is it enough to just say you were following orders?
You know, in one sense, yes, it is absolutely true. But, you know, all law understands that there is a moment when you can say, no, I will not follow this order. Even in the case where you yourself would be killed, I promise you, I mean, I don't know if it's true or not, but if I were put in a situation where I was told that I had to torture somebody or be killed, I would hope that I would choose to be killed. I really wish, I do not want to find myself in that situation. But if I found myself in that situation, I would pray that I would have the strength not to hurt somebody like that and be rid of the world rather than do something so inhuman as to go towards somebody who is defenseless. This problem of torture has to do with people who are absolutely defenseless. They are put in a situation where they are tied up and you are God. I would hope that I would never be put in a situation where I'd have to choose to be a God over somebody else, because I think terrible things happen out of that. I mean, in fact, going back to tradition, that's where Satan was born, right? Out of the idea that he was God.
Is that the question you want audience members to be asking themselves when they leave the theater after seeing Purgatorio? Maybe I should ask you, what question do you want them pondering?
Well, I would like them to ask themselves the question, who am I? I mean, am I capable of these things? How would I get out of that room? That's what I would like them to ask. I haven't thought of this, you know, but I would suggest that. But also, I hope they would say to themselves something like, did I spend my money right here? did I find myself on the right journey here? Has this playwright respected me in the deepest sense of the word, of understanding my options in life and filled me with these characters who are me and yet are distant from me, close and far away? That's my, you know, I'm an exile. I've been an exile almost all my life, going back and forth. So I like the idea of being very close to something at the same time, creating a certain distance so people can be really, I mean, I don't intend to change people. I just want them to take these words in and then do what they want with them, you know? Putting myself next to all the other artists who operate on us so magnificently all the time. It's such a privilege, such an honor to be opening this play 10 blocks away from where I wrote it. I've never done that before, you know. So to open this play with my colleagues, with my people from North Carolina, I've made this my home in spite of my New York accent, you know. And si hablar en castellano, if I spoke in Spanish, it was my Chilean accent. I'm from far away, and yet this is my home. And I'm very anxious to see how people react, you know, when they move in their chairs, what they'll say tonight, you know. On Friday night, tonight, I'm going to be listening to the audience, and then we're going to have a post-play discussion with the audience. It's going to be very interesting to find out what they think of it. I may be totally wrong. They may draw different conclusions than I do from the play.
With the little time we have left, I do want to ask you a little bit about the writing process, where you're at with the play right now, and where it goes from here. But just quickly, is it just a fact that once in exile, always in exile? Or are you always going to be far away?
I think we live in overlapping communities, and the deeper you go into the different homes that you have, the less of an exile you are. But, you know, there are certain things that are irreparable in life, in the sense that I am double. I do belong to Chile and I belong to the States. I'm a citizen of both countries. I belong both places. And that's my decision. I'm many people. But the important thing is to be at home with yourself, in some sense, to be at peace with yourself and the people you love. I mean, my wife, I love her very deeply, and my children, my grandchildren, my friends, my university. I have a space in that sense. How far we've gone with the process? We've gone very, very well. We've done a lot of wonderful rewrites. You know, David S. Bjornson is a fantastic director. He's directed Albie and Shakespeare on Broadway and many, many things like that. I don't know if I have 2 minutes just to tell a little anecdote about that.
Yeah, just about that.
Well, you know, in a strange way, that David Bjornson, as Bjornson, the first time I ever heard of him was here in Durham when I was writing a play called Widows with Tony Kushner, you know, the author of Angels in America. And we were working on that in 1990 together, 1989, and he was working on Angels in America. And the director he was working with was David S. Bjornson, and he was calling him on the phone. And so when Tony talked to me about David S. Bjornson, and I always thought, I'd like to work with him, you know? And the other day, we were having dinner here at a friend's house, at Zanny Voss's house, in fact, who's the producer of this here at Duke. And I said, you know, exactly 100 yards from here, if we could cross as the crow flies, I was sitting with Tony Kushner working on this, and he was calling you on the phone to speak about Angels in America. And here you are, we've come full circle. So talking about circles and loops, you know, life has a way of bringing the right people together. And I hope that all the right people come tonight to my performance and on Saturday and on Sunday, the matinee.
And in just about 40 seconds there, Ariel, what normally happens after a workshop production? How long before audiences will see a fully staged production of Purgatorio?
Well, you know, my impression is that we will be doing this on Broadway very, very soon. Certainly this year is the impression I had, because we had possibilities of doing it in London, and a couple of the you know, Gael Garcia Bernal of the Motorcycle Diaries and Tu Mamá También was going to star in it. And then Almodóvar took him away for La Mala Educación, which is
Pedro's always getting
film.
In the way.
Well, he was. I mean, you know, I put a curse upon him in that sense, but not a bad curse, you know. Maybe I'll be stuck in a room with him someplace because of that.
And
but,
work it out.
You know, but he took the actor away, and so we lost the theater, and I decided we should come to New York. And both the director and Ben Mordecai, the producer, thought that we needed these 2 weeks to work on the text, to right. prepare it, to bring some people in to watch it. And I think
and
by
Ariel,
the end
I'm gonna,
of this
I'm going to
have
to stop
it.
You there. So thanks so much for being with us today. Ariel Dorfman is a playwright and professor of literature and Latin American studies at Duke University. His new play, Purgatorio, premieres as a weekend workshop production at Duke this weekend. Cassandra Wilson is known as a jazz singer, but her band isn't a standard jazz combo. For one thing, there's no piano to support her voice with chords. She prefers to sing against the sound of a harmonica or maybe a banjo. And to lay down the groove, she's got a percussionist and a drummer. As part of the series Musicians in Their Own Words, Wilson described for us how her unusual approach to jazz has its roots in the music of trumpeter Miles Davis.
My father loved Miles Davis. I remember the first recording that I heard was Sketches of Spain. That music was so exotic to me because it was this jazz sensibility that Miles had combined with a sort of a classical thing. When I was getting into my finding my own voice, I would have to remind myself always, of what would Miles do? How would he say this melody? I had to quiet myself down, you know, and start to think, you know, more about making things longer and draping melodies across the bar line, playing with the time.
Our life is but a dream.
Blues came later for me because my father was not really into blues. The only time I would hear blues would be if my mother played some music, although we were living in Mississippi. And it's strange. They were so upwardly mobile that they really felt that the blues was not really necessary. I think also they figured out that, hey, you're going to get the blues anyway.
The man I love took from my best friend. That girl got lucky, stole him back again. You better come on in my kitchen, 'cause it's going to be raining outdoors.
After going through all of the work that I've done with the music, studying it, the discipline, transcribing Charlie Parker, getting into the very wordiness of that nature in the music, at some point it just clicked in my head that my way was much more about economy.
You can throw it away. You can throw.
Not concentrating so much on developing some fantastic technique or being able to scat sing like Ella Fitzgerald. It's about getting inside of the emotion, really projecting a persona through that music and taking your time with it.
'Cause you can never lose a thing if it belongs.
Jazz singer Cassandra Wilson. We heard from her as part of Musicians in Their Own Words, produced by David Shulman and supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And for today, that's the state of things. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment about our show, drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Rusty Jacobs.
Lay, lady, lay, lay across my big brass bed. Lay, lady, lay, lay across my big brass bed. Whatever color.